Welcome to Stories of Stories. I'm your host, Mike Chin. In each edition of this podcast, I explore the stories behind a specific creative project, process, or experience. I'll be talking about the projects on this show with the expectation that either you're already familiar with the project I'm talking about, so for example, if it's a story, you've already read it, or you don't plan to read it. Regardless, what I'm trying to get at is this podcast will include all kinds of spoilers, so please listen no further if you don't want anything spoiled. This episode, I'll be discussing Take Me Home. Take Me Home is a short story that I published with the Non-Binary Review in 2017. The idea for this story actually came to me in a trip to downtown Wilmington. My now wife Heather and I were actually touring prospective locations for our wedding. And I really like downtown Wilmington. It's a historic downtown area. And there's a lot of history kind of attached to that area, and specifically Wilmington, at least purportedly, used to be a pirate town. It's just off the coast, and purportedly it's a place where a lot of, kind of shady characters would show up. And so, seeing all these signs about ghost tours while we were, walking around and seeing different spaces. And I forget if I actually saw a sign for a haunted pub crawl there, or if that's just something that I had seen elsewhere, but one way or another, that kind of jived in my mind, this idea of setting a story on a haunted pub crawl. And as it kind of evolved, I was thinking about this story where a woman goes on this tour with her partner, who's kind of disengaged with her, and she meets someone who may or may not be an actual ghost on the tour. And this idea that the partner doesn't even really notice that she's starting to engage with this other entity, and that this other entity is kind of seducing her, and they go back to his place, and she finds out that he's just a man. And I don't think I ever fleshed out exactly what was going to happen from there, whether they might sleep together, or she might walk out on him, or if he might do something to cause her to walk out on him. But I had the idea for this story, and decided I was going to give it a try writing it. And I started in on it, and it turned out really dry. It just wasn't kind of going anywhere. It was kind of a very kind of standard story of just kind of a discontent kind of couple, and this ghost tour was feeling kind of heavy-handed in kind of how it was coming across. I couldn't find really a compelling way of making that character who may or may not be a ghost come across in any sort of ambiguous way without really just misleading the reader. But Halloween was coming up. This was 2015 when I was trying to draft this story. And earlier that year, I'd read Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in the Castle, and I absolutely loved it. And I'd actually encountered Shirley Jackson years earlier. There's a short story of hers that is, taught in some schools. I'd encountered it at least a couple times, called The Lottery, which is this sort of famous story where it's just this town kind of coming together, and it seems like some sort of, joyful community event, and there's going to be a lottery, and it turns out the lottery is to determine who's going to get stoned to death, and kind of this ceremony that they do. And that story always stuck with me, and for whatever combination of reasons, probably just because I was relatively young when I encountered that story, I never really followed up on Shirley Jackson. But then we read We Have Always Lived in the Castle in a story in my MFA program, or in a class in my MFA program, rather. And I really kind of fell in love with the voice of it. It's just so kind of eccentric and interesting. And so that Halloween 2015, I was reading another Shirley Jackson novel, The Haunting of Hill House, in honor of the season. And it clicked to me that I was really compelled by this sort of eccentric voice. And part of what's interesting to me is these stories in some ways sound a lot alike to me, these two novels by Shirley Jackson. But We Have Always Lived in the Castle is a first-person narration. The Haunting of Hill House is a very close third person for most of it. To this other character who has a very similar voice to Mary Cat, the narrator and protagonist of We've Always Lived in the Castle. And I just was really interested in this voice and kind of started to play around with kind of putting my own spin on it. And obviously, I can't claim to, have the same chops as a Shirley Jackson, but I like to think that I kind of espoused a similar style that was pretty successful for me. So in this case, the voice led to a lot of the story. There's definitely some interplay with We've Always Lived in the Castle, and you know, forgive the spoilers on that novel. If anyone intends to read, doesn't want anything spoiled, you can skip ahead in the podcast, you know, about 10-15 seconds and miss this. But basically, the implication is clear early on, and it's explicitly stated later on that the narrator poisoned her family. And so in my story in Take Me Home, there's a very heavy implication that the narrator, Angie, killed or participated in killing her mother. And it may have been, at her boyfriend Cody's insistence, or he may have at least been complicit in it. And there's this refrain that they're not supposed to talk about money from this character, with kind of the indication that they killed her to get their hands on the money. Angie is very rule-driven, and she's very curious. She does some peculiar things, like tasting the walls at the hotel to see if they taste like the ones at home, and to see specifically one wall that's next to a no-smoking sign, if that tastes like smoke. And there came this question. So I wrote this story, and I ended up turning it in for a workshop, just before Halloween, at my MFA program. And the question came back: you know, this character's meant to be autistic, because there are a lot of kind of cues kind of pointing in that direction. And I didn't, and I never have diagnosed this character. I sort of hold to this idea that most people in our lives, we don't have a diagnosis for them. People are walking around, and we have all these sorts of theories about, what's going on with someone or why someone behaves the way that they do, but it's all kind of speculation. And, I think that to me, that this character, that seemed kind of important, was not, necessarily putting a label on her, not necessarily defining her so clearly, but rather just kind of forming my own kind of rules is that she would want to follow and how she would follow them, and just kind of following through on that throughout the course of the story. And it ends up capturing something that I think is a really eccentric character, probably one of the most eccentric characters I've written, but again, without a clear diagnosis, but there's definitely some cues that she has sort of an unusual psychology attached to her. So this story, much like what I'd originally planned, does culminate in a scene at the apartment of this guy who, Angie's under the impression is a ghost. And I think part of why it works to kind of play with that idea that he may or may not be a ghost is because of the way her voice works, and because she's kind of obsessed with ghosts, that she's all too ready to believe that this guy, is a ghost. And so she kind of does some of the work for us, and probably, over-convinces the reader that that's what he is. In the original draft, there's a lot of elements actually kind of were maintained from how that works versus the final draft of the story, the one that was published. So in the original one, the man who it turns out is just going to be taking over the ghost tour and is starting to dress like that, starting to take on the mannerisms that he plans to use in that role. He makes a pass at her, and she kind of freaks out and ends up going outside and finding a taxi right away and demands that it take her home, because that's kind of all she wants. There's kind of some levels to that of, she wants to go back to, the life that she was living before her mother died, and maybe before Cody came into her life. There's a lot of childlike kind of qualities to her. And if nothing else, more literally, I mean, she's, out of her element. She doesn't travel very much, but her boyfriend's taken her out of town for this trip. Tells the taxi to take her home, and there's obviously going to be more discussion about where they actually have to go. Is she going back to the hotel? Is she trying to go all the way back to where she came from? And we don't really know that at that point. And I thought that was a reasonable ending, and I started sending out the story as such, and I went through a couple more patches of revision, and that was kind of the biggest piece I ended up altering, because it did feel a little bit sudden the way that the story ended previously. And then the cab showing up to pick her up when she was in a setting of this small New England town did feel like a little bit of a contrivance. There'd be a cab right there. If I were to redo the story, I could imagine her maybe calling an Uber or something like that to kind of make it fit a little bit more. But in any event, I decided that the way the story should end should be her going back to Cody. And these two characters who had started the story would also end it together. I sent her back to find the tour group, and got to write kind of some more fun pieces of the story, and including this implication that Cody didn't really even notice she was ever gone and had left. that, you know, he just kind of thought that she was around the bar while he was kind of flirting with these other girls on the tour, which is part of what set Angie off in the first place. But they come back together, and, you know, it shows why she would be with him, that he does understand kind of how she operates to an extent and kind of what her limits are, where she's going to be, you know, just too uncomfortable to function, because he does take her back to the hotel at that point. He's too drunk to drive, so she doesn't have any illusions they're going to go all the way back home. But they do go back to the hotel then. That's where the story ends. I went through a couple rounds of revision for this story, and then started submitting it. Got some personalized responses, which, I always say when the really good journals I admire, when at least a few of them are willing to engage with the story to the extent to send either a higher tier or a more personalized kind of response to explain, what they didn't think was working or how close the story was. That's always a cue to me that it's worth, continuing to try on it. And, I may do some tweaks, especially in line with the suggestions I get, but then I'm not going to, necessarily throw in the towel and, stop sending it out or start sending it to, journals just kind of willy-nilly at that point. So for this story, I kept sending it out, and it wasn't able to place it. And then I saw this call for submissions, from the Non-Binary Review. And the Non-Binary Review, I published a book review with them a couple years previously, and really liked the experience of working with them. And they had this call for submissions that was specifically geared towards, Shirley Jackson's We Have Always Lived in a Castle. It was kind of this lesson, and I've experienced this, a number of times, but, sometimes you have a really good story that it just doesn't quite fit, or it doesn't quite, kind of stand out from the slush pile enough, on its own merits. But if you find kind of the person who is actively looking for that story, it can be, you're just kind of a different, run for the story at that point. So in this case, journal was consciously looking for, stories to kind of link to Shirley Jackson and to that novel in particular. So, I sent them the story and explained, kind of my connection to that work and having read it and how it sort of influenced The Voice. And was really pleased that they ended up taking the story, including it in that issue, which I think is a really good issue. Themed in general about kind of works that are connected to that novel. Okay, so that's a wrap on Take Me Home. So we'll move on ahead here to Mike's monthly endorsement. So as an artist, I think it's important to be consuming other things to see what interests and inspires you and to see what's already out there and see what's come before you. So at the end of episodes, I'm recommending a book, story, movie, TV show, a band, a wrestling match, etc. That may have escaped a huge mainstream audience or that may be a little bit dated now and at the cusp of being forgotten, but that I nonetheless recommend. So staying close to the topic of this story, and I expect this podcast will drop in October, sometime around Halloween. I wanted to do something that was a little Halloween-y in its own regard. So I'm going to recommend Lock and Key. Lock and Key is a graphic novel. It's a series that was written by Joe Hill, the son of Stephen King, who's one of my favorite contemporary authors, wrote one of my favorite short story collections, 20th Century Ghosts, and it's produced some novels as well, like Nosferatu and The Fireman and Heart-Shaped Box. And it was drawn beautifully by Gabriel Rodriguez, this graphic novel. So it's set in this creepy old house where things are kind of haunted and kind of magical. And there's these magic keys that do different things throughout the house. So some of them involve kind of transportation, or some of them involve people becoming invisible, or all sorts of other things I don't necessarily want to spoil, because I think that's one of the real treats of this graphic novel, is how creative these locks and keys are. And what they kind of reveal and what they do for the story to kind of open up new possibilities as it goes along. So the story follows these two young brothers and their mother when they move to this house after the father of the family dies, and kind of figure out what's happening all around. And it's a series that it's scary at points. I think it's really exciting. Like many long-term projects, I don't think it ends quite as strongly as it begins. I think the beginning of this is just superb. And later on, I still think it's good. I don't think it's a bad ending, but I don't know if it quite lives up to the strengths earlier on in the project. Nonetheless, though, I think it's really compelling stuff and worth a look. So again, that's Lock and Key, the series by Joe Hill, drawn by Gabriel Rodriguez. All right. Well, as always, I want to thank you for listening, and I want to thank Mike Peek providing the theme music for this show. I'm wishing you all good health, happiness, and creativity, and I'll catch you next time.